Who we got here today? Kira is here. This is Dylan. This is David. Elise. Nathan. Emmanuel. Tyler. Jim. James. Jordan.
So. Talking about the Ottoman Empire and all its might, all its grandeur, giving you some aspects of the culture and society. It started with Usman's dream, all the sultans that came after him looked to conquer and spread Islam. And in the high point of Mehmed II's reign, when Constantinople was seized, every sultan after him was technically obligated to do so, but instead of actually leading men into battle, they basically did so behind palace walls. But they were able to exploit the size of the empire and the wealth by making Constantinople, during its heyday, one of the most beautiful cities on earth. And it implemented many things, including a regulated economy, in which the government basically made sure that there was good, solid money policy in place to make sure that business could take place in a fair and equitable manner. But interestingly enough, while there were Muslim merchants, and I'm not going to deny that, much of the commerce was actually run by daimen. Individuals within the society called daime. Daime are unbelievers in Islamic societies. Basically, non-Muslims who live in Muslim countries. If you are not a Muslim, you, by Sharia law, do not get equal rights, equal protections, and so forth. But obviously, the daime in any particular Islamic society depends upon which one you're talking about. Well, in the Ottoman Empire, there was a large number of daime who were Christians, who were Jews, because Byzantium was a Christian country. Empire that was conquered. And much of the Holy Land, the majority of the people initially were Christians or Jews. So the Ottomans basically had to govern over these people. But their religion did not regard them as equals. Now, by the way, Muhammad does say, essentially, that there are some daime that should be killed. In particular, pagans. But Quranic teachings do kind of put like an asterisk in the writing in dealing with Christians and Jews. Because Muhammad refers to them as people of the book. In other words, unlike any other religious group, the Christians and the Jews are regarded as having a special status in society. Not equal to Muslims, but not to the same level of being a pagan. Because Islam absorbed the Judeo-Christian traditions. So, all of the Abrahamic prophets are recognized as prophets in Islam. And Jesus himself was regarded by the Muslims as being a prophet. The only thing they refute is that he's the Son of God.
But Muhammad, in Islamic teachings, is the perfection. He is the perfect prophet, and he is the last. So, how do you deal with these Jews who acknowledge some of your prophets? Or the Christians who recognize all of the prophets except for the last one? Well, you basically allow them to live, but you restrict their existence. There are many, many, many restrictions that were imposed upon them. Essentially, they could live in society, but they could not serve in high-ranking government positions. So, a Christian or a Jew could be a soldier, but they could never be a general. A Christian or a Jew could be a tax collector, but they could never be part of the Sultan's council. But on some of the ones that I focus on year after year after year, being a lawyer that I am, there are a couple that always caught my eye. So for instance, if you were in the Ottoman Empire at its height, and you were Christian, and you thought a Muslim, say, stole your goat, technically, you could sue the Muslim to get your goat back. But you couldn't testify in court. You had to have a Muslim that would go in and testify that that Muslim saw the other Muslim steal the goat. But you couldn't go in and make the claim yourself. Because under Sharia law, daime are not allowed to testify against Muslims. Daime are not allowed to blaspheme. They're not allowed to say bad things about the Prophet Muhammad. Blasphemers under Sharia law are to be killed on sight. So they don't even get a trial. If a Muslim hears a Christian or a Jew say something bad about the Prophet, they have all legal right to enact justice, to kill them. So, can't testify, can't serve in high government places, you can't blaspheme. What happens if murder is afoot? Well, if a daime kills a Muslim, they get the death penalty. But if a Muslim kills a daime, the Muslim only has to pay a fine equal to one half of the Muslim's annual salary. So if daime kills Muslim, they're dead. Muslim kills daime, just pay a fine. Well, those legal restrictions are rough. Because it just goes to show you, embedded in their legal system, there is no concept of equality, of justice, like we have. Oh, on top of that, you also had to pay for the right to keep your religion. You had to pay a head tax called the jizya. The jizya was an undeclared amount. It was not set. So what does this mean? Well, you didn't even know when it was time to pay the tax. You might go a year or two or three, and then out of the blue, the tax man shows up at your door. And you had to pay whatever that tax collector demanded for every person in your household. If you could not afford to pay the tax for every person in your household, you had to give over your kids. Because then the kids would be taken and converted to Islam. Now, Now, of course, we have the Devshrim as well, don't forget. But the Devshrim is when kids were taken to serve as soldiers. Parents would give up their girls or their sons if they couldn't afford the jizya. Well, this explains why the Ottoman Empire went from being an empire of mostly Christians and Jews to one of mostly Muslims. Because it was only a matter of time, of generation two or three, before the families began converting to Islam. Because who wants to deal with this? Of course, the faithful will. But at times, it's really a pain in the tuchus. You live in a society and not legally being treated as equal. But there's also a dirty little secret that's part of Islam that it's not widely spoken about. Takiyya. Under Islamic tradition, Muslims are literally allowed to lie to defend the faith. In Christianity, Judaism, even Hinduism, Buddhism, lying is a sin. But in Islamic practices, Muslims can lie to anybody, even as other Muslims, to protect the faith. So, imagine for me this. A Muslim goes and talks to their Christian neighbor, talks about how wonderful it is being a Muslim, and that they should convert. The person converts. But maybe they don't like Islam. Well, the one thing that's usually not said is that once you become a Muslim, you can't convert out of it. To do so is an apostasy. It's a crime against the faith. And all religious people are bound to protect Islam. So every now and then, I haven't seen any stories in a while, every now and then, a story comes out in the news in America in which a Muslim father kills their kids, murders them, because the kids didn't want to be Muslims anymore. Now, of course, in America, they're punished for murder. But if they were in Islamic countries, that's not a crime. But they don't really share those details. Questions? So again, combination of all these things, when the Ottoman Empire seized Constantinople, it's estimated that the population of their empire was something like 80% Christian and Jew. But by 1900, 60% Muslim, 40% Christian and Jew. Now, I also have to be fair. I'm only interested in the facts. The treatment of Daime depended upon the times in which the person lived. Throughout much of Ottoman history, generally speaking, Daime were treated fairly. For instance, when Mehmed conquered Constantinople, he actually ordered that Muslims, Christians, and Jews from across the empire move to the city and work together to rebuild it. Interestingly enough, within the first few months, the Jewish population in Constantinople represented 10% of the population of the whole empire. Mehmed also handpicked the head of the Christian Orthodox Church. Made sure he didn't say anything bad about Islam, but once he picked the patriarch, he allowed the patriarch to tell the faith of the Orthodox Church. So the Christians essentially could stay Christians. And one other little interesting factoid, during the Reconquista, when the Spanish were driving the Muslims and the Jews out of the Iberian Peninsula, something like, 20,000 Jews fled from Spain and were allowed to come in to the Ottoman Empire and settle in modern-day Israel. So for the Sultans, it wasn't about them converting to the new faith, but rather it's what they could do, what they could contribute. But there were also times that Daime didn't have it so good. So one of the things we're going to touch upon when we get to the end of the Ottoman Empire, and maybe even when we get to World War I, is that during the death spiral of the Ottoman Empire, which happened to occur in World War I, the Ottomans unleashed a genocide. And they killed roughly, give or take, 1.7 million Armenians and another 500,000 Greeks, Christians, all under the fog of war. So, we have to be fair. Some years they had it good, some years not so much. Questions? All right. Now, unlike, say, Ming China collapsed, generally speaking, in about 50 years. The Ottoman decline was just slow and prolonged. One of the reasons why it took so long was that the bulk of the danger to the empire occurred from the outside coming in. By the 17th century, the empire stopped expanding, because it expanded up the Balkans into Europe, and it ran smack dab into Austria. It went up through the Crimea, ran smack dab into Russia. It went east and ran smack dab into the Safavid Empire, which we're going to talk about. So basically, it grew to the farthest extent that it could grow. And once you get to that height, the only direction you can go is down. Because the bordering powers, which we're going to talk about, started taking chunks. The Austrians, once they defeated the Ottomans at the Siege of Constantinople in 1683, they slowly began pushing down into the Balkans, taking Bosnia, Herzegovina, going all the way down. The Russians, the same thing. They moved down into the Ukraine, went down the Crimea, got all the way down as far as Armenia. So if you're in a vacuum and you have weak neighbors next to you, you can expand your borders. But the moment you come across nations that are powerful, you cannot. But that's not to say that the Ottomans didn't help themselves as well by weakening. Because similar to what we saw when we were talking about China, corruption began running rampant, as well as incompetency. Government officials basically bribed their way in to get jobs and did nothing but take money off the top. And once the money stopped going to the capital, the sultans were forced to raise taxes. But as I'm sure you all know, what good is taxing poor people to death? You know, they only have so much money, and eventually you're going to threaten their existence where they can't give any more. So when you started getting into the end of the 17th, into the 18th century, if you read the chapter on the Ottoman Empire, it references several peasant uprisings. The people began rising up against the Sultan. Of course, the soldiers had to go out and crush them. You know, that's not a good look. You also would have incompetent sultans as well. The great warrior emperors, the alpha males, gave way to weak beta males. Sultans who spent all their time doing things that were against the rules of Sharia law, I can tell you that much. Drinking and doing drugs and sleeping with all of their women in their harems. If you try going through life stoned, don't try running a business. You'll fail miserably. And definitely don't try being sultan of an empire. Because stoners have a tendency to only end up in one place. Mom's basement. So the Ottomans, in the 15th century, were the superpowers. Mehmed getting the bombards rolling across the lands with their massive armies. But by the 17th century, Europe had done the age of exploration. They got more land. They got more money, which meant they started getting more power. So had Mehmed attacked Italy like he was planning on instead of going against Dracula, history would have been very different. It's possible the Ottomans would have conquered Europe. But thankfully for Vlad, he ended up being a quagmire and sapped Mehmed's ability to continue the expansion. Because by the 17th century, the Europeans had a huge leap in terms of technological capabilities. At some point, I got to remember to put pictures in here. The bombards, 45 feet long iron tubes, were gone. And instead they were replaced by field guns, cannon. Small cannon that could be pulled by horse. The brass cannons that would shoot 8-pound or 10-pound or 12-pound cannonballs. Cheaper to produce, easier to fire. Higher fire rate. Yeah, you could hurl a stone the size of a VW, fire that gun, but it might take you all day to set it up and prime it. And then once you fire it, the gun could crack. That's, by the way, how Urban died. The poor guy, he was telling Mehmed, we got to slow down. We can't fire at the same rate that you want us to. But the conqueror was like, no. So they kept firing the bombard, and it got so hard, it got superheated, and the gun exploded. Killed Urban and his son. But by this time, Europe had switched over to the brass cannons, small guns. And I told you, the siege of Vienna. They had all their guns up on the walls, and they could shoot down. They had longer range than the guns the Ottomans had. The other thing, muskets. Guns had changed. The Ottomans embraced guns initially, but they were using matchlock guns. Again, you could look them up online. But a matchlock literally is a gun that has a trigger that you have a wick attached to, a slow-burning wick. So what you need to do is you need to put your gunpowder, once you ram it down the barrel, you put your gunpowder in the little pan, and you got to hope that the match, the wick, stays lit hot enough. So when you pull the trigger comes down and the match hits the powder in the pan. But just because it comes down, did you put enough powder in there? Is the wick hot enough? You could pull the trigger and it might not do anything until a few seconds later. Any of you ever fire? Any of you ever go to a gun range? Can you just willy-nilly pull the trigger and hit the target? It takes a lot to get your bullet downrange on target. It has to be optimum. Well, if you pull the trigger and you don't know when it's going to fire, you're never going to hit anything. Well, the Europeans by this time had matchlocks. So instead of the fuse, it was like a Zippo. The spark created by a Zippo, which was consistent. And you didn't necessarily need to keep it as dry as you did a wick. So the Europeans, they knew if they pulled the trigger, the round would discharge. Now, did the Ottomans have a chance to embrace this new technology? Yeah, but the Janissaries said no. So, I'll give you an analogy. The laptop that I use is a laptop that I got my son back when he was in like junior high. I had an identical laptop, but mine died. My laptop still runs on XP. Why? Because I think XP was the best operating system made by Microsoft. So my son comes home, he graduated 2 years ago and he's been deployed. He was over in South Korea, comes home on Sunday. I'm sitting there, comes home on Saturday, Sunday I'm doing some work, and he's like, how the hell is that thing still working? He's like, why don't you go out and spend money and get a new laptop? You know, my response is, it's good enough. It does what I need it to do. Well, the Janissaries knew all these other weapons were out there, but they knew how to use the old weapons that they had. And they said it was good enough. So they refused to make that leap forward. Now, what does this mean? Well, at some point, my laptop's going to die. Probably it's already infected with the state-of-the-art viruses. God only knows. But when that happens, I may be out of luck. I may lose all the data that I have on there because I can't back it up to the cloud. Well, the Janissaries wanted to use the guns that were popular in the 16th century, fighting against soldiers that had guns of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. Well, there's a big difference. So their own damn stubbornness made them weak. Another thing didn't help. Mehmed was the first sultan to order the construction of a fleet. The Ottomans had always been land-based armies, but he used the navy to conquer Constantinople. And several sultans maintained their navy. So for a while, they would actually take control of a huge chunk of the Mediterranean, shutting down trade, using the sea to attack the coastlines, raiding all of Europe. But in 1571, a combined Spanish and Venetian fleet shattered the Ottoman fleet when they tried sneaking out of the Straits of Gibraltar. The defeat was so total that the Ottomans never rebuilt the fleet. So they basically gave control of the Mediterranean back to the Europeans. And again, we did the Age of Exploration. We know what the Spanish and the Venetians and the Portuguese, all those people, what they were doing. They were going global and getting wealth, power, because they managed to go around Africa, not the Ottomans. Because once the Europeans could get around Africa, they no longer had to deal with the Silk Road. So the Europeans were in the driver's seat. But we talked about that already. We just didn't look at it from the Islamic spectrum. And the worst part was there were actually Islamic scholars in the Ottoman Empire that justified all of these mistakes, all of these failings, essentially arguing that no matter what's going on in the world, it doesn't matter. Only good things happen in the Islamic world. Anything outside the Islamic world, that's bad. So, they willfully close their eyes to the world around them. Well, if you're going to do that, there's no way you can no longer be a global power. Because eventually, the next empire up is going to knock you down. And that's essentially what would happen. But we're going to have to come back to it. Questions? Oh. I wanted to do a closing on Saturday. Kind of weird to think about that one. Sorry. All right. So spinning the world a little more, just beyond the farthest extent of the Ottoman Empire, was another Islamic empire called the Safavids. This would be the Ottoman Empire at its height, superimposed over modern Iran and part of modern Iraq, and going into Afghanistan. There's another empire called the Safavids. The Safavids actually began in 1500. But you've never heard of them because their empire only lasted about 200 years. They would be toppled in 1722. But they built an Islamic empire that was strong enough to challenge not only the Ottomans, but also the Russians and the Mughals at their height. Center of this empire is the modern country of Iran. And by the way, Iran, as it exists today, and many of their cultural and religious views still reflect the attitudes that were shaped back in the 15th and 16th centuries. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. All right. Unlike the Ottoman Empire, which was a sultanate, in which it was believed that the sultan was basically the emperor and the pope combined, the Safavid Empire, in its governmental system, was a theocracy. What is a theocracy? Anybody know?
Is it a religion-based hierarchy?
It's a governmental system in which the state religion is in charge. So it's not a monarchy where there's one person in charge. It's not a democracy where the people rule. But Theos, God. God is in charge. And the God that they happen to worship is Allah. But their form of Islam is different than the form embraced by the Ottomans. There are two sects. I suppose that's the best way to think of it, like a S-E-C-T, a sect, in Islam today. There are the Shia, and there are the Sunni Muslims. Kind of like the Protestants and the Catholics are both Christians. Well, the Shia Muslims and the Sunni Muslims were once together. But going back in time to a few years after the death of Muhammad, the Muslims, the followers, got in a big debate over who should succeed Muhammad. Because we have to remember that Muhammad was not like Jesus. Jesus was a preacher. Muhammad was a war leader. He was a conqueror. So, when Muhammad died, who are we going to have follow him? Well, the immediate successors were all relatives of Muhammad. They were mostly his generals. And these were men that were connected through Muhammad through marriage. Muhammad at one point had like 9 wives. And so he basically gave his girls, his daughters, away to these men. So basically they would become son-in-laws. But in and around the time of, I think, the fourth or fifth successor, Ali, when Ali was killed, there was no clear connection. There were no men who could claim to be family members of Muhammad who had connections. There were a couple of young kids, but no warriors. So at that point, the Islamic world had a debate. Who should be next? Well, the vast majority of them, the Sunni, believe that the next leader should be popularly elected. In other words, as long as the person's a Muslim, if all the people want him to be leader, let him be leader. But the minority, the Shia, claimed no, only a direct descendant of the Prophet can lead. FYI, today, 90% of the world's Muslims are Sunni. Only about 10% are Shia. And of those, 85 to 90% live in Iran. Why is it that way? Well, very simple. During the Safavid period, all other religions, including Sunnism, would be banned from the Safavid Empire. Every single man, woman, and child had to subscribe to the religion of the state. Questions? Well, who made this empire? Well, the empire itself arose from a cult-like group called the Safavids. The Safavids were practicers of a unique form of Islam in which it focuses less on simple prayers and more on actual deeds, known as Sufism. Sufism is a mystic form of Islam in which the individual rejects their identity. They essentially lose themselves in the religion. They don't see themselves as an I or a me. They see themselves as part of their religious community. And that's their only concern. Why? Well, they lose themselves in their love of Allah. They're like Tibetan monks who give up their existence, you know, to live at the monastery. Well, the founder of this form, this mystic form of Islam, is Safa al-Din, who happened to be a Persian who converted to Shia Islam. So, you have this physical connection with your religion through this mystic value system and belief. And of course, you accept that the only leader of your faith could be someone who's directly connected to the Prophet. Well, in time, Safi al-Din would gather disciples. And these disciples would be called Safavids. And Safavids is Persian for brotherhood. Now, the first brothers were simply people who were religious. But in time, the brotherhood was joined by local warlords. And political marriages started being made. And by the 1400s, the Safavids were kind of like a nobility. An interconnected political faction. To be a member, you had to acknowledge the eventual appearance of a blood relative of Muhammad who would one day appear on earth, known as the Hidden Imam. Sufis Shias believe that one day a descendant of Muhammad, a blood relative, will appear. They will declare themselves to the world, and they will basically trigger an apocalypse in which the earth shall be scorched with hellfire. And all of the non-believers will basically be burned in hell. Only the true believers will remain untouched, and they will inherit the earth. Now, by the way, that's one of the reasons why Iran has been trying to get the nuclear bomb. Because Iran is hellbent on triggering that nuclear apocalypse to destroy all the infidels.
So, is that kind of like the coming of Christ? Like how there could be a second coming of Christ? Like their way of interpreting?
Yeah. Except unlike Jesus, who was proclaimed the Messiah, who would unite everybody in peace. The Hidden Imam is going to kill off all of the infidels. Well, you put this faith with the fact that many of the members of this cult were warriors, and suddenly you have a combination of religion and militarism, in which war isn't just waged to get money, not just waged to get land, but it, in fact, becomes holy war. Which is known as jihad. The Safavids would raise their forces and would basically go to war with anybody who did not worship religion as they saw it. And they lost themselves in battle. The Safavid warriors were some of the most fierce, brutal warriors of their time period. Because they were not afraid to die for their faith. Because, of course, of the promise of the rewards in paradise. Is it like 72 virgins or something like that?
By the way, it's no coincidence that when Osama bin Laden, who was a Sunni, was given sanctuary in Afghanistan, in a part of Afghanistan that embraced Shiism, that he would wage jihad against the great Satan. Questions? Well, the conqueror for the Safavids is Ismail. Shah is the Persian king. So in 1501, Ismail used the Safavid forces and basically conquered all of the heartland of the Safavid Empire, much of modern Iran. And he imposed the will of the Brotherhood on the peoples that lived there. He also pushed the borders all the way into Ottoman territory, forcing the Ottomans to retreat. Once he had control of his empire, one of the first actions that he did, before worrying about like infrastructure or tax policy, you know, is there enough food for his people? One of his first acts would declare Shiism would be the state religion. Which meant, by law, to live in his state, you had to practice this religion. And by the way, they literally sent people house to house, village to village, to ensure that the population were Shia. Sunnis were given the choice to convert or die. Non-Muslims weren't even given a choice. They were just killed. No estimate on how many died. Could have been thousands, could have been hundreds of thousands. Don't know. They didn't keep good records. But in the end, once the non-believers were dealt with, they could then focus on creating a state in their vision. So they sent word out throughout the Islamic world to invite all Shiite scholars, scholars of the Shia faith, to travel to their realm. And they were given special positions called sadrs. A sadr is a government official. Kind of like the Shanxi in China. You know, the government officials, they had to go to the Imperial Academy, they had to pass the exam on the four books and the five classics of Confucianism. So they basically had to worship, or at least believe, in the state philosophy. Well, the same thing was true in the Safavid Empire. You had to fully embrace Shiism before you can work for the government. And your job as a government employee? Protect and expand the faith. Thus, religion would be the tool that the state used to control the population. So, all of the laws derived from Sharia law, all
life was regulated. All action was regulated. All behaviors were regulated based upon religious standards. And most penalties for violation, death. But religion became the focus of everything in life. The Safavid, for example, collected taxes. Taxes were used to build religious buildings, mosques, shrines, madrasas, religious schools. Crafts, arts, everything had religious themes. And they pumped their money into beautifying the state. But everything was on religious standards. So, for example, in Islam, you're not allowed to depict human beings in art. That's the reason why if you ever see images of mosques or structures in the Middle East, everything is mosaic. It's scenes. But you don't depict living beings. God, it might have been 15 years. Maybe not that far. I don't remember. But South Park got themselves into a little bit of trouble. Because in one of their shows, they were going to reveal a cartoon that had Muhammad in it. And they were actually Muslim terrorists from Europe and the Middle East that threatened to come over and kill Trey and Matt. So in the end, the South Park creators, they actually bowed down to the threats. So on the episode where they were going to reveal Muhammad, it was actually just like a black box. So you couldn't see him. But the funny thing is, this years before, they actually did depict Muhammad. It was something in the Super Friends or something like that.
I don't know, it was like one of the episodes from the first season.
But if you were to do that in the Safavid Empire, they would have been killed. No questions asked. Because that's the ultimate blasphemy. Now, as crazy as it would be from our perspective, the Safavid Empire did actually have some strengths that makes it worthy, if you're going to give it some time. There is a section in your book that talks about it in the chapter that deals with the three Islamic empires. One thing that most historians agree that it actually built a very effective government. I mean, after all, you can't have a strong society without a strong, effective government. And even though the rules of society were religious based, they did have secular components to it. So there were, for instance, there were police, you know, there were judges, you know, there were tax collectors, there were people who, you know, checked health and safety standards. It also won the lottery in terms of location. Silk Road, baby. Silk Road came down the mountains. Up here is Tibet. Came down through the mountains and entered into the Safavid lands before either going south of the Caspian Sea or across modern Iraq into the Middle East or going north to Russia. So even though there was the Asian trade network in sea, there was still a tremendous amount of land caravans bringing goods from as far away as Korea. All stopping here. Plus, they also controlled the Persian Gulf. So where do you think Persian rugs came from? This is one of the commodities that were desired across the Asian trade network. So they had goods to sell, they had money to buy. At its height, the Safavid Empire actually became a huge, granted it was Islamic culture, but it became a significant cultural center. People as far away as England, Ireland, Scotland, Russia, they wanted goods that were made in Persia. They wanted metalwork. They wanted textiles, carpets, tapestries. Remember, during the 1500s, people were still living in stone buildings. There was no air conditioning. There was no heat, electric or gas or whatever, steam. People got tapestries because they used it kind of like insulation to keep the wind from blowing through their walls. And rugs on the floor. And the richer you were, the bigger you could buy. The Safavids also loved the arts. Artists, highly skilled, painting, mosaics, architecture, poetry, all were highly regarded. And interestingly enough, many of the Safavids themselves were also artists. Ismail, during his lifetime, he was regarded as one of the best poets in the whole land. People would come from miles around to hear the Shah say his poetry. In Isfahan, it's on my bucket list. I hope to someday be able to get there. Isfahan, the capital, was in its height one of the most beautiful cities on earth. I was watching on the YouTube the other day, and there was, I think he was from England. He was kind of like a world traveler, and he got into Iran. As an American, you cannot fly from here to Iran. But as an American, if you wanted to, you could go to like England, and then you could get a visa from England that could allow you to get into Iran. But yeah, this guy did it. He went in there, and he's got videos of this. He actually went to Isfahan, and I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, oh, I'm like a little kid. Just gorgeous, opulent. It was built by the Shah Abbas I. This city was intentionally built not to be a city like how we think of cities, but rather it was supposed to be a representation of beauty. Because Isfahan is an abbreviation for Nis-e-Yahan, which is Persian for half the world. So much wealth was coming in from the Silk Road and the Asian trade network is at its height. You could find luxury exotic items from half the earth in the markets in Isfahan. It had parks, it had libraries, it had mosques, hospitals, hotels, eateries. And ironically, in its heyday, it was one of the largest cities in terms of population on earth. It was one of the few cities in the 1700s that had a population higher than 1 million people living there. Also had 170 mosques, 50 or 60 religious schools, thousands of shops, public baths. Oh, unlike Sunniism, Shiaism emphasizes the need for cleanliness. So unlike if you were to go to Paris in 1700, the people were actually clean in Isfahan. Questions? Well, unfortunately, the Safavids are like a comet or a meteorite, streaking through the sky, all bright, but it quickly burns out. Why? Well, simple. They maximize their footprint. And as history has shown us, if an empire does not grow, it dies. Well, just like with the Chinese dynastic circle, you know, their first rulers were aggressive, they were warriors, they had a mission and a vision. But by the mid to the end of their history, complacency sat in, apathy, corruption. The warriors, which were once feared, which is kind of there. If you have an army that no one on earth is afraid of, you're never going to win any wars. Well, as the rulers lost the will to rule, soon the priests took over. The Ulemas were a threat to the Ottoman sultans, because the Ulemas were the ones in charge of defining the religion, creating Sharia law. Well, the Shah's authority was only so strong as the priests allowed him to stay in power. But when the Shah started getting lazy and complacent, the Ulemas did something weird that they didn't do elsewhere on Earth. They would develop the theory, the qualification to be ruler, called Mujtahid. Mujtahid. To be Mujtahid, you have to not only be learned in Sharia law, but you have to be blameless. Only one devoted to the faith, and only one who casts no sin, could be chosen to rule. Well, here's the catch. Who determines the rules of the religion? Well, guess who determines whether or not you're blameless? Soon, the Ulemas, they would put somebody on the throne, and if that person suddenly started acting independently minded, the Ulemas would basically issue a fatwa, say that they have become corrupt, which would justify them being deposed. So the church controlled the state. Again, theocracy. That didn't help things. So you have inept, incompetent rulers. You have basically a seizure of power by the priests, setting artificial standards that they use could justify the removal of rulers. And you also have the Europeans pushing it. Now, unlike what the Europeans would do when they went into Indonesia or India, and as we're going to see what they would do to China and in Africa, the Europeans never really launched a successful invasion, per se, into the Safavids. But what they began doing is cutting off the flow of trade. So, beginning with the Portuguese, and then later the Dutch and the English, soon any good leaving the Safavid Empire, going into the Asian trade networks, had to be carried on European ships. And think of what makes the men in brown so powerful. UPS. Upis, or FedEx, some of the wealthiest companies on earth, because they make money simply taking goods from one point A to point B. Well, if you don't play by their game, the goods aren't going to come. And then what happens to your economy? Question. You also had uprisings. While there was very few, if any, rebellions in the capital, because the Safavids in that part of the earth is not exactly green and lush. Some of the provinces were in very rugged areas. Do you know anyone who fought in Afghanistan? Any men or women who did time in Afghanistan? Just if you do, talk to them. What were conditions like? You know, literally, you're in some valley surrounded by mountains, and there's nothing but like desert. It's cold. It's hard to get to. So, yeah, these people. Wait, this is the one place. These provincial leaders, because they could not be controlled easily, began breaking away and causing shenanigans, rebelling against the state. Oh, Trace here. All right, before I let you go, I realized I got to do attendance. Oh, Manuel's here. Deshaun. He's there. No, wait, you're Bryce, right? And plus, the Ottomans and Russians were also attacking. So you had the enemies trying to come in. So you put all this together, and you have this great empire stretched to its limits, but then slowly starts to crack. So let's kill it off, and we'll be done with the Safavids. Because I only got a little bit left, and we got enough time to do it. The empire was created by 1501. The end came by 1722. And how did it happen? Simple. There would be a rebellion in modern Afghanistan when a tribal people known as the Ashfaharians, who had been part of the empire, rose up and rebelled. Their leader was Nadir, who himself would eventually be given the mantle Shah. Nadir was a military genius. He was, in many ways, like the founder of the Ming. He was a peasant, served in armies, gained a reputation, eventually became a commander. He was feared and respected by everybody. It would be Nadir who would trigger a palace coup against the last Safavid Shah. When the army saw the coup going on, the army decided not to stick with the Safavids, but to join forces with Nadir. Why? Well, Suliyama anointed him to be Mujahid. They claimed he was the legitimate leader. Well, the moment the priest said, everyone followed. So the Safavids came to an end, and it marked the creation of what is known as the Afsharid dynasty. He and his descendants, all Afghans, worked together hand in hand with the Ulamas. From the 1700s all the way up until 1979. Actually, remember when this happened. But what you had was a complete commingling of church and state. They just are so entwined, they're inseparable. But the Ulamas allowed the Shahs to remain in place until 1979. When the Ayatollah Khomeini, who is the head Ulama, challenged the secular authority of the Shah, and would seize control of the state. Today, Iran has a president. But the only person allowed to run for president is the one chosen by the Ayatollah. The Ayatollah is like the Pope. He's the head ulama. The president stays in power so long as the Ayatollah wants him to stay. But the moment the Ayatollah loses interest in the president, there's an election, and one person gets like 99.9% of the vote. Today, the president of Iran is fully committed to paving the way for the reemergence of the Hidden Imam. Every now and then, a story gets into the newspapers that actually makes it over here. Which, again, to take you back to my point about Iran's desire to get the nuclear bomb, it's terrifying. So even though the Safavids and these traditions started hundreds of years ago, they are still present today, and they could come to roost in your lifetime. Because I'll tell you one thing. There was a movie that was on TV back when it was in the 70s. It was called The Man Who Saw Tomorrow. It was about Notre Dame. And supposedly, one of Notre Dame's verses talks about how death will come from the desert. And it also talks about how twin mountains will fall. And I'll never forget watching this thing. I'm like 8 years old on TV, and they show a nuclear missile smashing into the World Trade Centers. Well, how do you think I felt when 9/11 occurred? It's like, holy crap. So just be warned, my friends. You may like losing yourself on your little TikTok videos, but the world is a dangerous place. And there are people that don't care about you. So pay attention. Be knowledgeable. And that's all I got for today. Now, FYI, we're going to come back and we're going to do the Magals. I don't have much for the Magals, which means you might have your next exam this weekend. Just kind of saying.
So this weekend?
Maybe.